You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my personal capacity. Thanks for listening. When any president or president-elect picks an individual to serve in the executive branch as a Senate-confirmed political appointee, there is a process that is followed. Right now, you might be wondering what that process is, what rules or laws govern that process, and why some nominees get confirmed while others are not. Tonight, we're going to talk to a lawyer familiar with that process from his time on Capitol Hill. Eric Schwab previously served as the general counsel of the Senate Armed Services Committee under Chairman John McCain. And in that role, he vetted and advised on all nominations referred to the committee, facilitating bipartisan support for over 40 civilian nominations and over 20,000 military nominations confirmed by the Senate. He's now a partner in the Defense, National Security, and Government Contracts Practice at WilmerHale, but we're really glad he's here to give us an explainer. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Talk to us for a minute. We are going to ask you to educate us here. What are the rules that govern the nomination process?
So I think a good place to start is actually with the Constitution. Under Article 2, Section 2, it provides that the president shall appoint officers of the United States by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. Beyond that, actually, a lot of it is really within the Senate, and in particular, within the committees of jurisdiction. Most Senate committees that consider nominations have written rules concerning the process by which nominees are considered by the committee and voted on. Ultimately, what each particular committee is going to require from the nominee and how they go about deliberating on a given nomination is really up to the committee. And in particular, it's going to be up to the chair of that committee. Now, most committees follow longstanding committee precedent about what they receive from nominees in terms of documentation, how long committees consider a particular nomination before voting on it, if they do decide to vote on it, and what is asked of nominees, whether it's before the hearing or actually at the hearing itself. I think it's helpful to keep in mind what the underlying purpose is of the policies and procedures of the committee with respect to nominations, and that is to provide advice and consent. To do so, the procedures of a given committee is going to try to serve several purposes. One of them, and I would say first and foremost, is really to examine the qualifications of a given nominee and any potential conflicts of interest. And we can talk a little bit further about how they go about doing so. I would say, and at least speaking from experience about the Senate Armed Services Committee, which has a longstanding tradition of bipartisanship, that aspect of the procedures that the Senate has is fairly nonpartisan, and that is both sides have an interest in scrutinizing the qualifications and, more importantly, confirming that there are no potential conflicts of interest or any other legal or ethical impediments to that person being able to serve effectively in that position. And then I would say the other purpose behind the policy and procedures that Senate committees pursue is to influence policy through the confirmation process. And that could be either by rejecting or voting against certain nominees or extracting promises from nominees before granting consent to their nomination or promises from the administration or the agency at question. And for senators, their role providing advice and consent for nominations is one of the key levers of power that senators have and individual senators have. And that's in part due to the process by which nominations are voted on. But that is a key lever that senators historically have used to extract information from agencies, extract potential changes to policy, bring attention to issues that are of concern to them. And when one thinks about the fact that the legislative process can be very slow and senators may or may not have much influence in that area, the nominations process is an important lever of power that individual senators have maintained historically and continue to maintain today.
Okay. And I think the more technologically savvy you are, the more questions you would have about something like a vetting process. How does a Senate committee vet a nominee in an age of the dark web and highly anonymized cryptocurrencies, enhanced anonymity coins? How would they ascertain, what tools do they have and what did they get that would allow them to really scrutinize a nominee?
I would bucket the vetting process that a Senate committee undertakes in two buckets. First, I would categorize as the legal ethical bucket. Second bucket, I would call the policy or political bucket. Starting first with the legal ethical bucket, I would say that the executive branch actually does much of the labor on this front. So the legal ethical bucket includes a few key components. First is the nominee's financial disclosure and a resulting ethics agreement. All Senate-confirmed positions in the executive branch have to comply with federal criminal conflicts of interest laws. And that is, they can't be violating those laws. And part of the way that they confirm the executive branch for Senate nominees ensures that those nominees are not going to do so is through a process of cataloging through a report, public financial disclosure report, maintained by the Office of Government Ethics, which is an executive branch office, where that nominee is to report and answer a bunch of questions about the assets they hold, the boards that they serve on. And the agency that that person is being nominated to will review that disclosure report, which, by the way, is going to be made public, as well as the Office of Government Ethics. And they will require, if necessary, that nominee to either divest from certain assets or to recuse themselves from matters involving those assets or otherwise to seek a waiver. But it is critical, and this is something that is a law that all nominees would have to comply with, it's critical to be accurately disclosing your financial interests and entering into that agreement. The committee, the Senate committee that's going to be receiving a nomination is going to receive that paperwork. And I received that paperwork when I was on the Senate Armed Services Committee staff. But that paperwork will have already been rigorously reviewed and the agreement reached. And the staff's role is typically to make sure everything is in order, because those are just general legal requirements that they're going to have to be subject to. But making sure that that process is in order, and for agencies like the DoD that has an office dedicated to doing this sort of work and with Office of Government Ethics, these are pros in this area, and they have a well-honed process to scrutinize it and get a nominee's financial commitments and arrangements in a place where it needs to be for Senate consideration. In addition to that, historically, at least, and I'm speaking at least from the perspective of DoD nominees, is there would historically be a background report that's closely guarded. Staff would not have access to that. And that is provided on a close hold basis directly from the White House to the chairman and ranking member to review in private. And of course, the chairman and ranking member, if they have follow-up questions or requests, they can address those. But that has historically been a key part of the nominations process. But again, the FBI is conducting that background review and compiling that report itself. And that is an executive branch work product that the committee is availing itself of. In addition, most committees, I would imagine, particularly the Senate Armed Services Committee as well, though, have their own questionnaires. And these could be seeking more career-focused information, like prior jobs, prior speaking engagements, prior articles written, which for obvious reasons, a committee may be very interested in knowing and reviewing ahead of time. And it might include more intrusive questions about, you know, whether a person has been previously arrested or not. The more sensitive personal information is typically kept close hold on a committee staff, but is also part of the review and vetting process. Depending on the committee, the nominee could also be submitting copies of tax returns, also for review by the committee staff. And ultimately, in this legal and ethics bucket, it is largely a paperwork exercise where you are receiving, in some cases, some fairly voluminous information, highly sensitive personal information, some of which is public, like the public disclosure, financial disclosure report I mentioned, others that is obviously not public and is guarded very carefully by the committee staff. So ultimately, the committee staff, and often cases it's the general counsel's or nominations counsel on a given committee, can review that on a close hold basis and advise the chairman and ranking member who are really driving the vetting process for a given committee. So they can advise the chairman and ranking member whether they see any legal or ethical issues. And for the most part, that is a pretty bipartisan exercise. And at least in my experience, I would work closely with my minority counterpart because we both had an interest in making sure that a nominee had sufficiently complied with all the various legal and ethical requirements. And that's something that both parties generally want to do. If there's any questions about a financial disclosure report, conflict of interest issues, you know, those can be addressed with the nominee. They can always be brought in. But that is a threshold that nominees have to cross typically before the chair and ranking member are going to discuss and set a date for that person's nomination hearing.
Well, and you know, the nomination that seems sort of late, though, Eric, because I'm thinking, imagine that you are somebody in the executive branch and you like a person, they appear to you to be suitably qualified. Do you get a sense that there's thorough vetting that's occurred before they are nominated, or does that usually tend, in your experience, to unfold after the nomination process has occurred?
By and large, you do get the sense that vetting has occurred, at least with respect to the legal and ethical requirements that one is supposed to meet. Now, with respect to whether someone has policy or political positions that might be at odds, I would say you would expect an administration to be nominating someone whose views on those areas have been thoroughly vetted and are consistent with at least that administration's policy. But in my experience, and this is largely the exception to the rule, in some cases, they are not. And that can be particularly challenging when a president thinks his nominees is at least aligned with his party's views, and that nominee in the course of their, let's say, nomination hearings process is discovered to have contrary views to that party. That can obviously be very, very troublesome for one's nomination.
Sure. And then I also wonder, though, a lot of this stuff sounds like it relies on what I'll call self-report. I don't know that the Senate has staff that can, for example, go to a place where a person has done business, where they've lived, and maybe do a little bit more background research if there's a reason to believe that would be required. Is that correct? And do you principally rely on, you know, the thoroughness and database access of the Federal Bureau of Investigation?
That is correct. The committees don't have the staff to perform exhaustive, intrusive investigations of individual nominees. During my time in just over about under a year and a half on the committee, we confirmed over 40 civilian nominations, not to mention a very large number of military nominations. So, you know, as you point out, there is a fair amount of outsourcing that is occurring essentially where the executive branch, and we have trust in these agencies that are doing it because it's the professional staff of the relevant agency, it's the Office of Government Ethics, it's the FBI, is doing a lot of the intrusive financial and personal analysis. Where the other aspects of vetting comes in, frankly, the media plays a very large role. And this is true
for nomination hearings.
The Senate does have investigative committees, but it doesn't have huge resources. And I can tell you from personal experience, senators read what's in the media, their staff read what's in the media. And when someone is nominated, especially for anything approximating a higher profile position, if there is negative information out there, more likely than not, a media outlet is going to report on it. And more likely or not, that's going to get to either individual senators and or the committee staff. That will prompt questions. And those questions, the expectation will, they might need to be answered in the hearing or even before, if it's serious enough, the chair and ranking member may want those answers before they even agree to a hearing.
That's interesting. And I mean, that's the fourth estate role that you would want ethical journalists to be playing, is surface something. And that benefits, I guess, you know, even the president-elect or the president, because then they are learning something about the nominee and it gives them an opportunity to maybe reevaluate whether something was held back from them, whether they were in any way deceived or misinformed about any nominee. So that's very interesting to hear you say. But let's shift to the exact committees, because to me, I don't always know precisely which committees are in a position to both vet and have the authority to review nominations. And I think a lot of presumptions are made about which committees, because perhaps there's something in the title of that committee. But do you mind going over that for a little bit? For example, we have a DOD nominee, a DHS nominee. Like, who are some of the committees that would handle these various things?
So ultimately, there are Senate rules that lay out which committees have jurisdiction over which legislative issue areas. And generally, that tracks to nominations as well. So for example, Senate Armed Services Committee obviously has jurisdiction over the DOD. It also has jurisdiction over the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is actually part of the Department of Energy. So we, as part of that, because we have legislative jurisdiction over that DOD-related nuclear component of the Department of Energy, we also handle the nominations for that NNSA agency. You can get a sense of it from a committee's name, like the Homeland Security Committee. Generally, I believe it would be handling the DHS nominations. Like you said, it's not always apparent from just the name of a given committee. And there are some cases where you have nominations that straddle jurisdictions. And particularly, this is relevant for the intelligence community, where you might have what's called concurrent or sequential nomination, where a nomination has to be reported out from one committee before it then is sent to another committee, and for that other committee then to review and report that one out, or it's referred to two committees at the same time and they can both consider and act on those as well. And that's particularly relevant, at least in my experience, for the intelligence community. And that can obviously cause greater delay for certain nominations. The main committees that handle the most of the nominations on the Hill, first foremost, is the Armed Services Committee, where I worked, because in addition to the large Department of Defense, there are tens of thousands of military nominations. Most of them are routine that the committee reports out every year, but it also can include very many closely considered and extensive nomination hearings for four stars who are going to be serving in, let's say, the head of the military services or combatant commands. Other committees with major confirmation responsibilities are the Committee on the Judiciary, which obviously handles the nominations in the judicial branch, and the Committee on Foreign Relations, which handles, in addition to all the main State Department nominations, ambassadorial nominations, as well as foreign service officer nominations. But those are the main three committees. And obviously, there's many other committees as well that consider nominations.
I mean, it sounds like some of this also plays out in public. And I think that's interesting for the American public. I also have wondered, when I've watched some of those hearings, whether, you know, a nominee might be disincentivized to deliver candor, if you will, to a committee, because they're so concerned about how this would play out, or they feel like they might be brutalized by the process. And it's very interesting, not just to hear you talk about which committees, but the fact that some of this does not get passed to the members broadly for their use in any sort of hearing that might occur. Are hearings something that is required, or is that something that just occurs now and then? Because you're talking about 10,000 nominations for various things. I can't imagine that that could really be managed through any kind of hearing process.
That's correct. That it's ultimately up to a given Senate committee to decide which nomination hearings it holds. For the Senate Armed Services Committee, the vast majority of nominations are considered routine. It's multiple nominations on one list. It does go through a process, you know, internally, but largely those will just be voted on without a nomination hearing. And even for the one or two or three star generals and admirals, they will typically not get a nomination hearing either. At least for the Senate Armed Services Committee, the civilian nominations, which are all senior officials in DOD, assistant secretaries and above in both the military departments, as well as the overall Department of Defense, those people generally receive nomination hearings. Nomination hearings can often involve multiple nominees. You know, for example, the Secretary of Defense is going to have their own nomination hearing, but lower level officials, you could have panels of two, three, four, five, even where multiple people are testifying at a given time. And that's to really give senators an opportunity to ask questions, but also a recognition that you do have a very large number of nominations to get through. The committees have other orders of business as well, considering legislation, doing policy-focused hearings. And so they both want to make sure senators are given the opportunity to scrutinize nominations and ask questions in a public setting, while at the same time recognizing that there is only so much time. And by and large, assuming that a nominee meets these legal ethical requirements, they want to move expeditiously on nominations, whether to report them out or not, but to move quickly in order to provide the leadership to these agencies that senators, you know, want them to have.
Sure, sure. And I don't think anybody's ever interested in stymieing sort of continuity of government, if you will. I mean, they want things to keep running in what is, you know, frankly, the greatest country in the world. But let's talk about preparation. You've mentioned some things sort of behind the scenes, if you will. I'm not asking for specific anecdotes from your history, although I know you probably have thousands. But how does the committee, any committee, prepare for a hearing? What sort of things take place before that happens?
So once someone, as I mentioned, gets through these legal and ethical wickets to make sure they've met those threshold requirements, it's the chairman's prerogative to hold the hearing. Depending on the committee, they will, you know, frequently consult closely with the ranking member and make sure they're both aligned on that. At that point, depending on the given nominee, generally there'll be a staffer on the committee who's considered the lead on that nomination. And that person will align with the subject matter that that nominee would be covering. So for example, when I was on the committee, I was, in addition to managing the overall process and vetting all nominees, I was also the lead for the general counsels, as well as the IGs who were nominated. So as part of that process, I would, at least in our committee's case, we would put together what's called advanced policy questions. It could be a very voluminous set of questions that the staff will put together and other people can provide input, but asking essentially for that nominee's views on a wide variety of substantive policy areas. Those questions will be sent to the nominee in advance of the hearing, and answers will be received in advance of the hearing. It is a rather delicate dance that nominees often have to do in order to provide both substantive, fulsome responses while at the same time not provoking any fights that they don't want to provoke. There are cases where nominees can get into hot water before their even hearing begins by providing answers that can range at either from they're trying to obfuscate an answer or to they just provide what's in the view of the chair of the committee, the wrong answer. And so there is a way to navigate that. There are legislative affairs personnel at these agencies who have a lot of experience doing this, but it is a useful exercise for the committee staff and also obviously the senators on the committee to try to get substantive information from the nominee and to help inform the questions then that they would ask of the nominee at the hearing. So that's at least for the Armed Services Committee, a key component in sort of the pre-hearing prep. Beyond that, the individual senators on a given committee will be prepped for that hearing by their personal office staff, generally. And for these senators on the Senate Armed Services Committee, at least, they're going to have a national security advisor, staffer, or a military legislative assistant staffer, but someone who's going to give them background on the nominee and draft a series of questions. Obviously, a senator may or may not ask any of those questions, but the staff prep work for those members of the committee will be done by the personal staff. And they might reach out to the professional staff on the committee to get information, insight, advice as well. But oftentimes, those are very knowledgeable staffers in the personal offices. They'll know their boss very well and the lines of question their boss wants to pursue. The committee staffers are going to be writing the questions for the chairman and ranking member. And obviously, those are two very important questioners that are at a given hearing. And the questions that those two ask carry a lot of weight in terms of the expectation of the type of responses they're going to receive.
So what I want to say is what I have observed over the years is some people on the Hill, some members, I mean, are just talented at sussing out of any nominee whether or not they're actually qualified to be appointed to any position. Some of them are very artful questioners. Now, it appears to me, Eric, that those questions are not always received in advance because it's been obvious in some cases that a nominee was absolutely flat-footed and didn't know something essential that they should know if they were going to ascend to such an important position in the executive branch. You talk about things being written out and questions in advance, but there obviously is something in the nature of almost a cross-examination that occurs. How does that happen?
Ultimately, that aspect of preparation really for the nominee is going to depend upon who that nominee has around them, preparing them for them. In the case of oftentimes you would have the agency that person's being nominated for, their legislative affairs office being involved in that preparation process, transition team, if you're talking about very early in an administration, some nominees also hire their own personal counsel or advisors to prepare them for that. But you're absolutely right. It's sometimes hard to prevent being caught flat-footed, but time and thoroughness in that process is very important. And you're right, there is a wide variety of sort of the quality of questions that can be asked to nominees. I would say some members of Congress are perhaps more naturally gifted than others. If you know the substance and you do your homework, and this is true for both the senators who are asking the questions and the nominees who are trying to prepare for it, you can both ask really great questions and you can also respond with really thorough answers. It is truly an art form on responding effectively to questions, not a science, because there is a sweet spot between wanting to address the question and not look like you're being evasive or filibustering or being antagonistic, while at the same time recognizing that you can't always give a yes or no answer if the question, even if they're asking, demanding a yes or no answer. You can't always make certain promises that you know you're not, you don't have the authority to make. Right. And to do that in a way that shows due deference and respect without either getting over your skis or sort of writing checks that you're that you can't cash is a delicate dance.
Yeah. So let's talk about this, though. So let's say you have a nominee, and we've seen this with both parties. I mean, let's be clear. Sometimes nominees appear ill-considered when new information comes to light about them, and a president or a president-elect finds themselves ambushed with information that their team wasn't able to surface. But what factors impact whether and how quickly a nominee can be confirmed in your experience?
So it can really vary. And I think one of the things that has been frustrating for those probably both, well, for sure, certainly going through the nomination process, and even for those who work on the Hill, is that the process seems like it's only getting slower and slower. So first and foremost, you know, with some exceptions, if a nomination is referred to a committee, the committee is going to need a vote on it and is going to need to report it out. The chairman has a big role in that process playing out. But oftentimes, the holdup is not with getting a nomination voted on in committee and reported out. Oftentimes, the holdup comes after that. And the underlying structural reason why it can take longer than you might expect, and that is, okay, it's been reported out of committee, why don't we just vote on it? is the way the Senate works in what is colloquially called a limited number of floor time. And unless you have unanimous consent of all senators for a nomination, in which case they can be approved very quickly, you need to expend floor time. It definitely would need a Senate procedural expert to delve into this, but more or less, there is a limited amount of floor time in a given Congress. And that floor time has to be spent on considering legislation. And for the Senate Majority Leader, they have to consider what to spend that floor time on and what nominations to spend that floor time on. And in at least history, a recent history, there has been a high priority given to lifetime judicial appointments for the obvious reason that those are lifetime appointments.
Yeah.
So if you have a limited amount of time and you can get through more judicial appointments, which more likely not, especially in this given environment, you're not going to get unanimous consent for. So you have to expend floor time to do a roll call vote. Then you're going to oftentimes be prioritizing those nominations over at least those at lower levels in various agencies. So unless you're lucky enough to fall into the unanimous consent area, you're going to be essentially in a line to get floor time and to be voted on. And I think there's been some actions taken to speed up that process, but that is going to be key. And oftentimes what's unfortunate, but it's part of the process, a unanimous consent is withheld because there is a hold placed on a nomination by one or more senators. That hold may or may not have anything to do with that individual nominee. It may be because that senator is trying to get certain information from the agency. It may be because that senator is objecting to certain policies that the executive branch is pursuing. And that person's nomination, which would otherwise be able to receive unanimous consent, is not able to receive it. And that can also delay it.
But can that be a filibuster? I mean, can somebody create a situation through filibuster where, you know, that could present the kind of delay to a nomination that would just leave it dead in the water?
It is the threat of a filibuster is what prompts then the necessity of a floor vote. So because any given senator can filibuster, unless you have that unanimous consent where people have agreed not to do so, you're going to need to do a floor vote. And that's what takes the additional time to ultimately get something approved.
You know, separate from this whole idea of a filibuster threat or, you know, floor time is because we always hear about horse trading on Capitol Hill. And I think to the average American, that seems a bit murky and, you know, that it's sort of extra principle. Whatever, you know, a member has said they stand for, there's a lot going on behind the scenes in terms of getting what they want that causes them to compromise positions. But is that something that happens with this process or really not?
Especially when you're in a situation where you have a hold on a nomination, there can be very extensive negotiations between the executive branch and that given senator. The executive branch will know who has the hold. The whole point of typically having a hold is for it to be known, at least so with the executive branch, so you can try to achieve whatever it is you're trying to achieve. And those negotiations will hopefully be successful and break the logjam, so to speak, and allow that person to get a nomination vote. There is obviously cases where a nominee is, it's clear enough that that person does not have the votes to be confirmed. In that case, that what is typically done is that's going to be communicated back to the executive branch, and that person will withdraw their nomination versus being voted on and being rejected. And I would say, you know, obviously it depends on whether the executive branch party is also in control of the Senate. But where I've seen nominations really go crosswise and not be successful, it's less of an issue with the minority party, because obviously they're the minority party. It's often with of one party having issues with that person's own party in the Senate. And that is...
Sure. We've actually seen that, right? We've seen that several times lately. With both parties, where there's just no support for a nominee within the party of the person who nominated the individual.
And given the amount of time nominations can take, one really hopes, both for the sake of, you know, the government and the country overall, that those nominees are few and far between, because anytime you really get into the process and you get pretty far down the road and the nomination does not work out, it can take considerable time to get another nominee vetted, all the paperwork put together, their nomination sent to the Senate, it considered, and you can be years into a four-year term and a position is still not filled. So having someone who is confirmable, it can be critical to the, you know, proper functioning of these agencies.
Yeah, but we've, I mean, over the years, and this is with both parties, we've seen things like persons nominated to be ambassadors of countries where they don't know anything about that country, and the country is maybe strategically significant for the United States. And a lot of them seem to withdraw the withdraw from the process themselves. Let's go back though for one second, because not everybody's going to understand how Senate process works. What numbers, for example, with, let's say, Secretary of Defense or one of those bigger cabinet level appointments, what numbers are needed in order for a nominee to be confirmed?
Well, the rules changed over time, but now you simply need a majority. So that would be 51 votes, or if your party is also controlling the Senate, then you can use the vice president to be the tiebreaker vote. But that's it. In the past, it used to be, I believe, probably a 60 vote threshold, but that's been done away with now. And so the threshold is lower for, you know, the top nominees, the secretaries. They're going to get a vote anyway. They're going to be prioritized, especially in the national security field. But for lower level nominees, that's where things can get slowed down, because the majority leader needs to decide, well, do I put up a judicial lifetime nomination, or do I put up the assistant secretary for one of the military departments who, you know, might serve for 2 years? And, you know, typically they will choose to prioritize the former. And so even with the lower threshold needed for the vote, and the fact that these guys probably could be confirmed if they did get a floor vote, they may not get the opportunity, or may not get the opportunity as quickly as you would hope.
And then we haven't mentioned this, but then there are tons of positions that don't require confirmation.
In fact, the vast majority of political appointees are going to be not Senate confirmed. And obviously, those people can be very influential in those positions, but they do not go through the Senate nomination process.
All right. Well, I think we'll end it there tonight. And then I think next week we'll probably be talking a little bit more about sort of the workarounds that people have found over the years to this process when a president or a president-elect becomes dissatisfied with the response from people on the Hill, from members in particular, to their nomination. There are things that they can do, and we will get into that in more detail next week. But I just want to say thank you, Eric. This has been very, very helpful to understand both the vetting process, sort of generally what the rules are and that the committees write them themselves, you know, and which committees handle some of these more, I guess, national security oriented nominations, and sort of what happens behind the scenes for preparing for these. You know, no matter what I hear about the prep process, I still feel like there's got to be a better way to surface all the information possible about any nominee in the interest of, you know, the American people and sort of the protection of these various agencies where they might go. But who knows, maybe that'll be the AI tool that dazzles us all at some point, right?
Yes. Well, it was a pleasure talking with you, Lisa. And this is an incredibly important topic always, but especially now with any new presidential administration.
Always. Yeah. And I really appreciate you very much for giving us the time. Eric Schwab, he's been the general counsel of the Senate Armed Services Committee under John McCain. And just so you know, he is presently a partner in the Defense National Security and Government Contracts Practice at WilmerHale. We'll link his bio in the notes to this cast. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure you share this episode with a friend and try to discuss any topics we've covered in a thoughtful way. Make sure that you listen to other people's opinions and arguments, because it's going to improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country more diverse, not just in our population and its ethnicity, but also in thought, than any other country. Our writer and producer and host is me, Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the Just Can't Stop Holly McMahon, who is still standing after this conference. And of course, all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Make sure you join us next week because we'll go deeper on this topic. Be well.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.